Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. On Sunday night, you might have noticed when Daniela Vega made history at the Academy Awards ceremony when she became the first transgender presenter at the Oscars. With us now is another transgender woman who has many firsts to her credit. Sarah McBride was the first trans person to speak at a national political convention. That was the 2016 Democratic one. Before that, she interned at the White House. Again, the first transgender person to do so. In a new memoir, Sarah McBride writes about her journey and how her gender identity shaped her politics. She is now the National Press Secretary at the Human Rights Campaign, the leading LGBTQ civil rights organization. Her book is called Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. Sarah, thanks so much for coming in. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Your book starts off at a very critical moment in your life. You're in college. You're in a frat. Were you the student body president yet?
Yes, it was. It was during my term as student body president.
And
it was really through that experience that I was able to gain the courage, the confidence, and the insights that I needed to finally accept that fact that I had known about myself my entire life, that I'm a transgender woman. I came out to my parents on Christmas Day in 2011. And fortunately, with their support and the support of family and friends around me, on the last day of my term as student body president at American University, I came out to the broader campus and to the world as transgender in the student newspaper.
Given what we usually think of as the mindsets of frat brothers, how did your frat brothers deal with it?
You know, I was fortunate enough that when I was in a fraternity trying to prove to myself and to other people something that I knew I wasn't, that I joined a fraternity filled with a lot of loving, compassionate people. A lot of gay men were in the fraternity. And so when I came out, they responded with nothing but love and support. I remember when I first posted my coming out note and the comments started flooding in, I got a knock on the door to my office in the student government office. And I opened the door, and there were about 10 fraternity brothers standing there with their arms open, ready to give me a hug, to make clear that while I may not be their fraternity brother anymore, I'd always be their sister.
So we shouldn't stereotype frat brothers any more than any other group as a group.
This is definitely a group that defies the stereotypes.
What prompted you to come out at that particular point in your life? Were there specific events that led up to it?
You know, I think it was the culmination of 21 years of struggle. I am someone who has known that they're transgender my entire life. I remember some of my earliest memories lying in my bed at night praying that I would wake up the next day and be myself. And I think the challenge—
And be a girl.
Yes. And I think the challenge for transgender rights in a way that differs with the fight for gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights is that it's difficult for the non-transgender population, cisgender people, to empathize with the experience of having a gender identity that differs from your sex assigned at birth. And for me, it felt like a constant feeling of homesickness, that unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that would only go away when I could be seen and affirmed as myself. And unlike geographic homesickness, which dissipates with time and getting used to your new surroundings, this homesickness only grew with distance. And so after 21 years of that homesickness eventually becoming so all-consuming that I thought about it every single waking hour of every single day, I realized that I couldn't continue to watch my life pass by not living my life.
And listeners, we invite your phone calls with maybe your own coming out stories. If you're trans or anything else you want to say or ask of Sarah McBride, who is press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, LGBTQ activist group, but also now the author of Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. You write about being aware very early, and you just said that again now, that somehow you felt like a girl before you knew what transgender was, like with the two sisters in your neighborhood who you played dress up with. Can you tell that story?
Sure. You know, I remember going over to a friend's house, Courtney and Stephanie Seitz, when I was 5 or 6, and away from the parents up in the playroom, I would put on the Disney princess dresses that they had. And my favorite one was a Cinderella dress. And I just remember in putting those dresses on and being sort of seen as myself, a longing and an incompleteness that I didn't fully understand at that point, but that longing and completeness going away. But it wasn't until I was 10 years old and I was watching a sitcom with a transgender guest character that I, one, found out that this was something that other people experienced, that there was something I could do about it. But also at the same time, it became clear to me as the laugh track cued every single time a character would express any kind of interest in that beautiful transgender character that I'd also potentially be a joke if I came out. And at 10 years old, you don't know a lot, but you know you don't want to be a joke.
That's such an interesting story from the early part of your book. Being a kid who's experiencing what turn out to be transgender feelings, and the first time you heard the word transgender, it was watching a sitcom with your mom.
Yeah. And I remember looking over at her and asking my mother, you know, is that real? Are there people like that? And she said, yes, sort of nonchalantly. They're called transgender or something like that. And it was both life-affirming in finding out this piece of information, but also my heart dropped as I looked at her and knew, oh my God, I'm going to have to tell you this someday, and you're going to be so scared and disappointed.
So when did you come out to your family, and how did they respond?
It was in late 2011 on Christmas Day. I remember the previous evening, Christmas Eve, being in church, listening to the choir in the Presbyterian church that I had grown up in, sing "O Holy Night," and looking up at the stained glass windows and just knowing that I couldn't continue to let this beauty escape me, that I wasn't truly living in the present, I wasn't truly living my life, and that I needed to come out.
So you were already in college then?
I was in college. I was a junior in college. It was in the middle of my term as a student body president. And I told myself I'm going to come out after Christmas. But my mother, noticing as the empathetic person that she is that something was wrong, she came to me after we opened presents and said, "You seem so down. What's wrong?" And I thought, I have the courage to say it right now. I have the confidence to say it right now. And I told her that I was transgender. And they were so scared when I came out, scared of rejection in every sense of the word. And I knew that this would be a response from them, and they made clear that they loved me and supported me, but my mom expressed this feeling that I was dying, that they were losing their child. Because I would look...
They were losing their son and gaining a daughter.
And that's what... I told them that they were keeping the child that they've always loved and gaining a daughter in the process. But it was difficult in that moment to really internalize that, and particularly because I hadn't started actually living my life as myself. It seems sort of so abstract and in the future. And my mother, you know, she in the first couple of days, she asked my oldest brother, who's an openly gay man, she said, "What are the chances that I have a gay child and a transgender child?" And my brother, who's a radiation oncologist, said, "Mom, what are the chances that a child is diagnosed with terminal cancer? Your child is not dying. They're not going anywhere. You're not losing your child. This will be okay." And I think he needed to push back. And from my perspective, I wanted my parents to eventually get to a place where they were asking that question, "What are the chances?" Not out of pity, but out of awe. Awe in the diversity of our family, awe in the strength of the children that they raised who are able to live their authentic lives.
And it must be weird for a parent. Do you think it's different? Is this too general a question? Do you think it's different for a parent to deal with their child coming out as gay or lesbian than as transgender?
Absolutely. And particularly when I came out 6 years ago, before the sort of, quote, transgender tipping point that we have experienced, my parents made very clear when my brother came out that they loved him and accepted him. And they made very clear to me that they loved me and they accepted me. But when my brother came out, they knew gay people. They had reference points for people who were gay, who had partners and were successful in their careers. And they didn't really have that comparative reference for transgender people. All they had was what I had, which was the references of a punchline in a comedy or a dead body in a drama.
So where do you think we are? You talked about a trans tipping point. Is it possible to compare to gay and lesbian rights and general societal acceptance, sort of where we are on that scale? You know, is it 1970? Is it 1980? Is it possible to draw a connection?
Yeah, I actually think, I think oftentimes we have people say that they think on trans rights were in the 80s or 90s, and I think that that's far too pessimistic of a take. I think on trans rights, we are probably around 2005 and 2006, right after that marriage backlash. Just as I think the progressive movement and the Democratic Party and I think, frankly, fair-minded Americans were beginning to regret the experience of opposing gay rights and opposing marriage equality. And just at the beginning point of that really broader acceptance by fair-minded Americans, by progressives, by moderates of gay rights as a legitimate issue of civil and human rights.
My guest is Sarah McBride, author of Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to tell your own story or ask Sarah a question, 212-433-9692. And Anna in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to extend, Sarah, like a happy Women's Day tomorrow and all transgender women a happy Women's Day. I think we don't do enough. I'm straight, and we don't do enough for inclusion, so I just wanted to do my part.
Well, thank you, and happy Women's Day, International Women's Day to you. I think it's so important that we recognize the diversity of womanhood, and I think womanhood and this world is enhanced by the diversity, by the different identities and experiences all of us bring to our collective identities as women. So thank you for that, and right back
sure.
at you.
Thanks.
Anna, thank you very much. When you were a little boy, feeling like a little girl, or even as you grew up, can you describe what it was that felt that way? Like, the progressive mindset says that so much about gender is socially constructed.
Right.
Right? We now know that girls can be strong leaders,
right.
that men can cry and be vulnerable. It's not about who you're sexually attracted to, because that could just be being gay, which is something different. We're all trying to break the old gender stereotypes that are socially constructed by thousands of mm-hmm. years of enforced patriarchy.
That's absolutely right.
So for you as a progressive, what felt like a girl that felt biological, if that's the right word, or otherwise couldn't be denied?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. I think the first thing is that transgender people, for instance, transgender women like me, have always been girls and women. We just weren't seen as that. Gay and lesbian people weren't straight before they came out as gay. And so for me, you know, the way I look at it is I've always been a girl. It's something I've always known about myself. It just wasn't seen and affirmed by society for the first 21 years of my life in the same way that for far too many gay and lesbian people, their sexual orientation is not seen and affirmed by society.
But what were the elements of that essential girlness?
And I think what's important is that, you know, there are certain sort of socially constructed cues and experiences that we associate with different genders, that in participating in those things, the pain for me started to go away. But it wasn't, oh, I like dresses, so I must be a girl. Oh, I like these things that are traditionally associated with being with femininity, and so I must be a girl. Because none of those things are inextricably linked with womanhood.
Right.
And so for me, it wasn't this sort of intellectual experience of I like dresses, so A equals, or you know, if I like dresses, then I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's this more visceral knowledge of, one, that pain, and knowing when the pain goes away. The pain goes away when people acknowledge through language, through interactions, the affirmation of my gender identity. And, you know, I think the point you raised, though, about the social construction of gender is a really important one, and it's one I had a lot of conversations with my father about, who's a progressive like me, and who said, you know, I thought gender was a social construct. And my response to him is that gender, to me, is a lot like language. Language is a social construct. The words we use, the grammar we use, all of the different elements of language are a social construct. But they still express very real feelings. Happiness is a real feeling, for instance. But the word happiness is a social construct. And just like with gender, where there are an infinite number of ways of expressing that deeply held gender identity, there's no stereotype that everyone should or have to abide by. In the same way, that feeling of happiness or that feeling of sadness, there are nearly an infinite number of different ways, both in language and cues and nonverbals, to express those very real feelings. So something can be a social construct in the way we express and the way we interact with the world, but that doesn't change that there can be a true, deeply held element of one's identity within it.
Beautifully said. It's almost like you can't necessarily put it into words, but you know it when you experience it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, I think an example a number of people use is if you're right-handed and you start writing with your left hand and someone says, how does that feel? And you're like, well, it doesn't feel right. And how do you know? Well, it just doesn't feel right. At a certain point, it becomes impossible to define pain or define that experience beyond just the basic of it doesn't feel right. It hurts. And that's what it was like for me.
Lynn in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
First of all, just thank you for speaking out on this. My granddaughter is about to be 10, and by the time she was 4 years old, she could tell us that, I know I look like a boy, but my spirit is a girl. Mm. When we would play house, she wanted to be the mom. If we played Star Wars, she wanted to be Princess Leia. It was just always so clear to her. Luckily, there has been zero pushback from the family or the school. She goes to school in a dress. She's just a girl.
Right.
There has been no problem. I, as her grandmother, live in fear that a problem will crop up for her. But, you know, people face challenges all the time. And so hopefully things continue to go as smoothly for her as they are, because she's just a little girl and she is very, very happy.
Well, that brings so much joy to my heart. And I want to start by saying thank you for loving your grandchild. And I think you and it's clear your family have provided her with one of the single most important things in this journey, which is a supportive social network and a supportive family. That is so important. And I think in my life, one of the things that brings me more joy than anything else is getting to meet young transgender kids, young people who are doing what once seemed so impossible to me 20 years ago when I was growing up. They are both living their truth and dreaming big dreams all at the same time. And like you said, that's a byproduct of social change. It's a byproduct of advancements in science and research. It's a byproduct of families welcoming a transgender loved one with broad smiles and open arms. And so I just want to thank you for helping to transform impossibility into reality today.
Lynn, was it easier for you as a grandmother than it was for the parents?
No, it's very interesting. At first, Mia, I think she did what a lot of trans kids do. She wore dresses at home and went to school in boys' clothes. Mm. And it was her mother. One day, Mia came and said, I'm going to school in a dress tomorrow. I think she was 6 at the time. And her mother said, okay. And my daughter-in-law said, when I let her off for school, I said to myself, well, good luck. But kids just accepted her for, maybe it was because she was so young. But, you know, she went to school in a dress and has never looked back. And in our family, we're lucky. We have great grandparents. Everybody is just on. It's just who she is.
Yes.
My son always says when he'll tell people his daughter is transgender, that they'll give him a lot of props. Oh, you're so wonderful and accepting. And he says, isn't that sad? You should not be wonderful if you love your child. Mm. You should be criticized if you don't. Mm.
Lynn, thank you so much.
Amen. Thank you, Lynn.
Angie in Somerset County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Angie.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Sarah. I wanted to get back to your comment, Brian, earlier, that you wondered if about Sarah said his parents, particularly his mother, thought about losing a child. And that's a very real kind of experience for a parent who has a transgender child. I have one. And I think that my son probably came out, you were talking about Christmas of 2011, Sarah, and I think my son came out Thanksgiving of 2011. So there are so many expectations you don't realize you have of a child when they are one gender versus the other. I remember thinking, oh my God, my kid is never going to walk down the aisle in a white dress. And that process, giving myself the time to process that, but always accepting that this took courage for him to tell us. He deliberately wanted us to know who he really was. And in spite of all that fear and that expectation, it was our role as parents to love this person who we had helped to create. So, Sarah, keep talking about it. I hope that you're right. I hope that we are, in terms of rights, in 2005 instead of the 90s. I fear the current political climate a lot. This is probably the one thing that's motivated me to be most politically active, is that I'm concerned about my child's rights as an American citizen. But thanks for having the show, because it is so hugely important.
Angie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie.
Bye-bye.
Turned into a little bit of a therapy session for parents and grandparents.
Well,
right?
and Lynn was absolutely right that you know, my goal is to get to a place where we don't have to thank parents for loving their child, but sadly that's not the case. So I, you know, Angie, thank you for loving your child, and thank you for creating the space for your child to live their life more wholly. And I think, you know, one of the things that was so clear to me when I came out, both in watching my parents mourn in my loss, but this loss, but also in stepping out into this world as my authentic self, was just how much we interact with gender in our day-to-day lives, just how much our hopes and our dreams and our visions for the future are inextricably linked in so many ways with our perceptions of a person's gender identity. And then to your point about the political climate, I think it is so important for folks who aren't transgender, who maybe don't have a marginalized identity, to understand just how scared people are in this country, and to understand that after the election and for the last year and a half, far too many people have had to wonder whether the heart of this country is big enough to love them too. And that is something that no one should have to experience. But I will also say that I have seen, and this is one of the reasons why I think we're in 2005 on this issue and not in the 90s, is that every single time a politician comes for us, whether it's Pat McCrory in North Carolina or Donald Trump with the military and trans students, it creates a national dialogue that only serves to open hearts, change minds, and ends up sowing the seeds of the destruction of the politics of hate that those politicians are employing. And so there is an alliance of allies, a growing alliance standing with us in this fight, and every single time they come for us, it only makes us stronger.
And it's so great that parents and grandparents have been calling in and sharing their stories of acceptance, because I think it not necessarily opens the hearts. I think parents' hearts are open to their kids almost automatically in almost every case, but kind of paves the way for some parents who might be struggling with it right now to take that next step.
It models the right behavior, because acceptance provides a standard while rejection provides an excuse.
Last question. We had a caller who couldn't hold on, who's a school counselor, I think a guidance counselor in elementary school, and wanted some advice from you on how to deal with kids at the school level who may be transgender or expressing transgender expressions of some kind or another at a relatively early childhood level.
Yeah. I think two things. One is take your cues from that child, from that young person. I think people think that people are too young to know their gender identity. But when it comes to non-transgender kids, you know, we never go, oh, you're only five, you can't know that you're a boy. So take your cues from that child. Do what that child requests. You know, oftentimes that school might be the safest place for that child. And allowing that young person to be respected and affirmed in that school can not only be the right thing to do, it can be life-saving for that child. And we know that when transgender young people are allowed to live authentically and be seen as themselves, it doesn't just allow them to be whole. It actually allows them to pursue their dreams and thrive academically.
Sarah McBride's book, with a foreword by Joe Biden, is called Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.